given Dave 24 hours to resolve the whole disappearing kids deal, and John had to admit that not only had the deadline long passed, but that the situation was now actually quite a bit worse. The two men unslung assault rifles and took up positions opposite their prone captives. Ted screamed, "Where are they?" Dave said, "Where are the what?" "The kids. You've either got them here or somewhere else." Okay, as implausible as it was to accuse us of simultaneously kidnapping the two kids before, this is just weird. We snatched 10 children and made them vanish into thin air? What, did we show up with a panel truck and just load the little bastards in there while nobody was watching? In a building inhabited by heavily armed biker types? No. See, I think you've got capabilities, and I think you use those capabilities for shit like this. John said, "We found Maggie. Why would we take kids just to release them again?" "Exactly so you can do that. In a couple days, you were going to go to some locked room you've got them in, let them out in front of a bunch of TV cameras and get called heroes. Probably think you'll be drowning in pussy." Amy said, "I think you're a good person, but there is just so much going on here that you don't understand." "Well, by all means, miss, educate me." "You don't want to hear it." "Try me." Dave said, "Have you noticed anything weird about Maggie?" "Don't turn this shit back on her. You want to guess what alarm system the motel was using? You want to guess what happened the moment the kids were taken?" John was about to say that was ridiculous, but stopped himself. That was weird. Both John and Dave looked at Amy, and she didn't look back. Dave said, "We're being framed by whatever is behind this. That's just part of it." Amy said, "If you want to search this place for the kids, go right ahead. We'll wait right here on the floor, okay?" Dave said, "Just watch out. There's artwork out there that will reveal the modern world to be an edifice of lies." Still, John was pretty sure that Dave had the same thought he did, which was, "But what if they do find the kids here?" Before he could even finish the thought, there was a loud metallic bang from below them on the first floor. Everyone froze, listening. Bang. Ted and his partner raced for the stairwell. John scrambled to his feet and ran after them. Behind him, Dave and Amy had a hushed argument he couldn't quite hear. At the bottom, John was met gun first by Ted's comrade, who'd been stationed there specifically to make sure the three of them didn't try to take out Ted from behind. The guy shouted something about how John wasn't to take another step if he didn't want to see his intestines go bouncing down the stairs like a slinky. From where John was standing, he could just see Ted edge toward a rolling metal door, on which was spray-painted an Uncle Sam next to a word balloon that said, "I am full of lies." There was a bang, and the door shook. Ted said, "Hello? Can you hear me?" If he got an answer from the other side of the door, John couldn't hear it. The door shook again. "We're here to help you. Back away." The latch on the floor was held closed by a wad of rusty brown chain and a heavy padlock. It looked like no one had touched it in a decade. Ted switched to his shotgun, blew the chain apart, then reached down and yanked up the door. His companion turned to train his gun on the opening, glancing back at John to make sure he wasn't going to try to take advantage. If John could have frozen time in that moment and taken the rest of the day to think about it, he still wasn't sure he'd ever have successfully guessed what was on the other side of that door. Was it the supposedly missing kids? Mikey? Dioji? Nymph? Some other kind of imitation victim that would turn Ted against them, like his wife? A doppelganger of Ted himself? A stray cat that just got trapped inside the room somehow? Dennis Rodman? The door rolled up to reveal a dark room. Some old cans of paint, a few dusty blue barrels of floor wax. John had seen just the hint of a pale shape when Ted's friend said, "Oh, shit!" and started firing. Out from the shadows popped a pair of white, leathery wings stuck to a sinewy grasshopper body. The creature the locals had dubbed Bat Mantis. The monster launched itself forward and swiped a claw at Ted. He jumped back and found he was now holding half of a shotgun. The rest was clattering to the floor, the creature having effortlessly snipped metal and plastic cleanly in two. gunfire, and shouts. Both men were backpedaling quickly, but with purpose, creating distance, getting out of their enemy's attack range. The Bat Mantis absorbed a dozen rifle rounds, and then leaped forward again, swiping with a crooked limb and sending Ted's partner crashing into a wall. It then quickly skittered away, clumsily, like its legs kept getting caught on one another. Instead of running for the main exit, which was about 20 feet away, the thing crashed directly into the wall, mashing itself into it like it didn't understand how walls worked. As Ted continued to shoot it in the back, the Bat Mantis kept pressing itself into the wall, misshapen feet scraping the floor. And then, it was gone. Right in front of them, the thing had dissolved through the wall like a handful of pudding slapped through a screen door. There was a muffled shriek from the other side, like the beast had injured itself in the process. Ted flew toward the main exit. John followed. The moment they were outside, the Bat Mantis jumped into the sky, flapped its wings, and was airborne. Ted fired into the sky with his assault rifle. Not in a blind rage or confused panic, he was taking careful aimed shots, intending to bring down his prey. Once more, Ted fell right into professional soldier mode. He could take time to be amazed by what he saw later, after the job was done. John was pretty sure the shots were landing, and fully expected the creature to splash down onto the pavement, dead. But the Bat Mantis just recoiled with the impacts and kept flying, vanishing behind the next building. Ted sprinted after it. John followed, cold rain battering his cheeks. They rounded the building and caught a pale glimpse of the beast. Ted unloaded on it, shooting until the magazine went dry. No effect. Then they were running again, Ted's boots slapping and splashing, the man frantically scanning the clouds as they pissed on his upturned face. The creature was gone. Ted cursed the sky. John, thinking quickly, stomped over and jabbed a finger at him. Hey, listen, we tried to tell you. I get that you pride yourself on being hard-headed, but you see it now? You want to know what's taking this town's kids? Well, now you know. Ted said, why didn't you tell me that thing was in there? You hoping it would rip my head off? Because we didn't know. It was waiting in there to ambush us. Probably because it knew we were getting close. How the fuck would we get that thing in there? This was, of course, bullshit. But chasing the Bat Mantis seemed like a perfect task to keep Ted out of the way. Still, the questions being asked were the right ones. Why in the hell was the thing holed up in the Beanie Weenie warehouse? John assumed either he or Dave had in fact lured the thing in there over the course of their lost weekend. But how? And more importantly, why? Did it have something to do with the silicone butts? Look, John said, here's the truth. We've been stalking this thing for months, learning how to track it. That's why it tricked your little girl into thinking it was Dave there that night. It's using its tricks, trying to throw you off the scent. Wait, then who was Nymph? They're one and the same. That's just another face it wears, a different type of predator, a human one. He transforms like a werewolf. He's a were-bat-mantis, a bat-mantis man. What matters is that underneath it all, it's just an animal. It can bleed, and it can die. Find out where that bastard nests, you'll find the kids. Let's just hope you find them in better condition than they've been finding the dogs. The dogs? It eats small animals. I say you sit down and map all the houses or farms where people have lost dogs and cats and chickens. Then you draw a big circle around all them houses and draw an X in the middle of that circle. That's where you'll find your monster, and God willing, that's where you'll find the kids. If you got a good relationship with the cops, you might be able to get them to help out. Unfortunately, that's not our situation right now. The cops want nothing to do with us, and we've got an agency on our back on top of that. In fact, if you see black trucks prowling around somewhere, driven by spooky assholes in black robes, I'll bet you'll find they're hunting for the same thing. Ted said, if I find out this is bullshit, The monster that just flew out here was not made of paper mache and pipe cleaners. I'm telling you now, Ted, that thing is going to try to scramble your brain. That's what it does. Don't let it. I don't give a shit if you believe me or not, but if you can't trust your own two eyes, what can you trust? John was proud that he was able to keep a straight face through that last part. Me. Amy and I watched John trudge back toward us, soaked to the bone. Ted's partner had already vacated the premises, jogging off through the rain, clutching wounded ribs. John nodded sideways and said, "They parked down the street. Hopefully they'll head off to spend the next month trying to find that thing's nest. God only knows what it was doing there. Unless one of you know?" I said, "Did you see it phase through the wall? It can do that, but it still managed to get trapped in a supply room? I think it's just an idiot." Amy said, "It started making noise when Ted pointed a gun at us. Maybe it was trying to protect us." I would love to spend just one day in your world. I know that came out like sarcasm, but it's not. I seriously would. John said, "All right, we need a game plan." I said, "Well, we have to figure this all out before Ted turns his attention back on us, and before the Maggie thing hatches, and before Tasker figures out how Nan can murder us all without consequence, and before the manhunt for those missing kids draws the entire town to the mine, and before the biker gang blames us for all this, and before the Batmantis comes back and eats us." I raked back wet hair from my forehead and sighed. "Anybody hungry? Didn't they say Waffle House wasn't closing no matter what?" John said, "We need to go to the mine, right? I mean, that's the root of the problem." I said, "So let's say we go there and find 10 kids standing around. Then what? And don't say kill them, because Amy is going to start screaming. Whatever we do, it's better than letting the bikers find them. We're seeing through their disguises thanks to the sauce, but who knows how long that will last. I say we go down there and, I don't know, we've got all that sulfur. Maybe you throw it on them and it breaks the spell or something. Plus, we have all those butts. Would you drop the thing with the butts? You know why you bought those? So that you could bring them up every 5 minutes." Amy said, "What? Butts?" We piled into the Jeep. I was in the passenger seat and had the sudden urge to pull down the sun visor, even though the morning sun hadn't showed up for work in a month and was clearly trying to get fired. A note fell into my lap. John's handwriting. Amy asked, "What does it say?" "It says, don't let the Bat Mantis out." Chapter 20. The Ass Letter. John wanted to stop by his place to get gear for the mine mission and possible Millibutt showdown, but instead we wound up spending half an hour carrying electronics and furniture up to the second floor. John had some standing water in his yard and garage, but the house itself was up another few inches above the waterline. Still, it felt inevitable. Amy had pointed out that even if the rain stopped, runoff from higher ground would push the flood into his living room. It was going to be like that everywhere. There was just no place for the water to go. I said, "What if it doesn't stop? What if the water just keeps coming, like those floods you see on the news where it goes over the rooftops?" John said, "Then it's all up to the insurance, I guess." "No, I mean, like, yeah, I'm worried about your stuff, but in terms of the town, what happens? All these moldy, waterlogged houses. Would people finally just leave? Just abandon this place?" "Dunno. I don't know why people stay here now." "Why do we stay here?" Amy said, "It sounds like you're rooting for the flood." "I kind of am." "You could put an end to the whole thing if you just buy some boots." John said, "I'm going to dig around in my garage to see what I've got in the way of enchanted weapons. Look around for any more cryptic notes." John left, and I looked in the fridge. I didn't find any notes, but did find a piece of leftover pizza. I took a bite of it and said to Amy, Am I crazy, or does it smell like perfume in here? You think John's back on the girlfriend wagon? Amy, as if resuming a conversation she was having in her head, said, What would you do if it was your last day on Earth? Amy, I'm not worried about this thing killing me. I'm worried about it filling the world with weird monsters. Do you have any idea how many calls we'd get? Tell you what, I'm just canceling my phone altogether if that happens. Live like it's 1995. I mean, just as a hypothetical. You've only got 24 hours left. How do you spend it? Like, say the doctor said you just had one day to live. I'd spend the last day trying to find another doctor. Or researching a cure. There has to be something left to try. I mean, why would I be putting so much stock in some doctor's opinion? You remember Dutch Voglis from high school? He's a doctor now, in Indianapolis. He was a dipshit. Fuck that doctor. It's just a thought experiment. Like, let's say you accepted the diagnosis and knew you only had one day. I'm not confused by the question. The answer is I would spend the last 24 hours refusing to accept that it was my last 24 hours. I'll tell you right now, if there's such a thing as fate, it can eat a bag of dicks. This answer clearly annoyed Amy. I scrambled to think of a way to change the subject, but before I could, she said, I think you should see a doctor. What? You think I have a terminal illness? If so, that was a super weird way to bring it up. No. About medication. For your moods. This is totally not the time for that conversation. It's absolutely the time, because you're up. You're feeling energetic because you've got a project. When this is over, you're going to get planted on the sofa again, and when you're like that, it's like talking to a grumpy log. Amy, I'm not depressed because of brain chemicals. I'm depressed because I don't have a job and don't have any skills or education. Because I've wasted my life. There's no drug that's going to make me okay with that, other than alcohol, I guess. The point is, I don't need a doctor. I need work. I need a reason to get out of bed in the morning. That's what the drugs are for. They get you up off the sofa so you can go fix your life, find a job, get out of this cycle where you spend all day in bed because you're depressed. But the thing you're depressed about is the fact that you wasted all day in bed. We'll talk about this later. You know for a fact that we won't... But I was already heading upstairs to escape the conversation. I entered the master bedroom. John had a very expensive king-sized mattress and box spring, but kept both of them on the floor, insisting that he never understood what the rest of the bed was for. And I admittedly had no answer for that. There was a television mounted to the ceiling so that he could watch it from bed. The thing looked like it weighed 100 pounds and would crush his skull if the screws came loose. The bed was made. That was not typical. A quick glance around confirmed that yes, a woman was staying here. Girly clothes in the closet, makeup in the bathroom. This was hardly an unusual circumstance, but keeping it from me and Amy was very unusual, to the point I don't think it had ever happened before. I would say that maybe he thought we wouldn't approve, but holy shit, when did that ever stop him? He's been hanging out with Nikki for more than a decade, and I work so hard to avoid her that she hasn't even appeared in this story yet. She's got a PhD in some useless subject, and is one of those people who laughs at her own jokes, and absolutely no one else's. Don't get me started. I searched the room for notes from ourselves, found none. I made it back downstairs at the same moment John was walking in from his garage, holding a medieval mace with 3-inch spikes. He said, Okay, I've got Buddha's mace here. It's about 2,500 years old, but it should still work. I said, I was actually hoping it'd turn out we had built some kind of super weapon in your garage while we were on the sauce. A big monster-killing bomb or something. John said, Well, we've got all that sulfur and the rubber asses, yes. Hey, who's staying here? Who's... what? If it's none of my business, just say so, it's fine. I just... you know, normally you're open about it. I don't know what you're referring to. There's plainly a woman living here. Her clothes and stuff are in your closet. Unless they're yours, which, again, the only thing that would bug me is that you didn't feel like you could tell me. John looked confused and more than a little alarmed. He stomped up the stairs past me, mace in hand. We followed him up and watched as he flipped through the skirts and tops in the closet, then examined the pile of makeup and face washes on his vanity. That stuff was not here before. Amy said, "Well, is this some kind of monster-related thing, or did you just have a squatter? Maybe one of your girlfriends got flooded out and came to stay." John said, "Not without letting me know. They'd have been incinerated." "Well, maybe they did let you know while you were tripping on the sauce, and you just don't remember." John gestured toward the clothes and said, "No. Look." Amy studied the clothes and said, "Hmm." I said, "What?" She said, "These don't belong to anyone we know." "How do you know?" "Because I've never seen these outfits before. I know what John's friends wear, David."
"You do?"
"This black skirt with the slit going halfway up the hip? Try to imagine any of the girls we know wearing that."
"Okay, give me a minute."
John said, "No, she's right. This is weird." I said, "It certainly is. Crazy how your day can start off perfectly normal and then something like this happens."
"Yeah. All right, let me run to the bathroom, then we'll go."
He was going to the bathroom with the owl jar above the toilet. John would smoke weed in front of me, but not meth. Weird, the little boundaries people have. The moment he was out of earshot, Amy said, "So let me get this straight. If you were confronted with a life-ending crisis, you'd fight it to your last breath, but you're perfectly fine with slowly drowning in a warm pool of your own ennui?"
"My own what?"
"What if I told you that you were possessed by, like, a powerful sadness demon, and that it was feeding off your life force? Would you fight it then? How about if I told you it was coming for me next?" "What are you talking about?"
We heard John burst out of the bathroom. He charged into the room, breathless, and said,
"Dave, I need to see your ass."
I stared at him for 40 silent seconds.
"Why?"
"I found the next note. In advance, this time. It's written on my penis, in magic marker. It says, 'Check David's ass. There's an important message written on it that contains valuable information.'"
I said, "It clearly does not say all that."
"You want to see? You won't even need to get too close because the font is..."
Amy said, "David, will you show him your butt?"
I gritted my teeth and glared at John.
"You did this. You're the one who dude wears my card this shit."
"I have no memory of that."
"Yeah, that's kind of the point. Why are you yelling at me instead of showing me your ass?"
"You stay here. I'll go check it in the mirror." A minute later, I stormed back to the kitchen. "It says don't let them, and then the letters SCR, and a scrawl across to the other cheek. As if I woke up to find someone writing on my ass and then violently slapped their hand away."
John said, "Shit. Don't let them scr. Don't let them scream? Screw? Scrape?"
Amy said, "Guessing is pointless since we don't know how much more there was to the message."
"Well, it'd have to be enough to fit on one human ass.
Screw the pooch? Script a sitcom pilot?
Scrawl things on your butt?" offered Amy.
I said, "God damn it, we've wasted an hour and we have nothing to show for it."
Amy said, "And we had so much to show from the previous 80,000 hours before that."
John got a notification on his phone and said, "Marconi's here. They're parking at the vacant Walmart. Says it's on pretty high ground."
I said, "Good for him.
He says he wants to meet."
I threw up my hands.
"We might as well. Anybody have anything else they want to do before we go fight the monster? Anybody need to run to the DMV, get your license renewed?"
Amy said, "You want to swing by the doctor?"
Chapter 21. We all must learn from Kurt Russell's tragic mistake. Marconi traveled in two huge RVs he used as tour buses, one for the man himself and another for his production crew. He was even less interested in anonymity than John. His enormous face was airbrushed on the side, though I noted it was on the production crew's bus, where Marconi's was a nondescript white and gold. Meaning, if a crazed fan tried to force their way onto the bus to murder Marconi, they'd likely get the wrong one. I wondered if he kept a bearded assassination double in there. John, Amy, and I, we were sitting pressed shoulder to shoulder in the cramped office in the rear of the bus, which it turned out was where he'd taken our Skype call earlier. The wall with the accolades was in fact the least interesting of the four. The rest of the room was stuffed with exotic artifacts. Whether these were genuine items collected from haunted houses and dig sites, or cheap props created to look good in the background of his TV show, I didn't know. If it was the former, I was guessing it wasn't exactly legal to take some of them from their countries of origin. There was a crystal skull, a golden chalice, and an ancient-looking spear with a head of chiseled obsidian. Alongside these were seemingly random items, a Raggedy Ann doll, a clay bust of Lionel Richie, and in the corner, a one-armed concrete snowman covered in bird shit. On his desk, Marconi's pipe was leaning against an antique figurine that looked like some kind of Egyptian god, only it had an enormous, erect penis almost as big as its torso, the figure's left hand wrapped around the shaft. Marconi asked everyone if we wanted a bottle of water. John and I declined. Amy said yes, as she always does. She must just like getting free stuff. When he returned and handed her the bottle, he nodded toward the penis figurine and said, "I thought you'd like that one. It's the Egyptian god Min, popular in the 4th century BC, the god of fertility. It is believed that during the coronation of a new pharaoh, he would be required to masturbate in front of the crowd to demonstrate that he himself possessed the fertility powers of Min. If you have watched a State of the Union address, you will find that the ritual has not changed much." He took a seat behind his desk. He said, "It appears social media rumors have coalesced around the idea of a white winged creature snatching the town's children and building a great nest of their bones in one of this region's many abandoned buildings." I said, "Yeah, we may have accidentally started that rumor. You have to admit that's way more straightforward than the truth. There is no element of truth to it, as far as you know." "I don't think so." "Shit, I don't know. I have no idea what's happening anymore." "Does such a creature exist?" "My team said if the YouTube video is a fake, it is an excellent one." John said, "It exists. We've seen it up close. Very close. Don't think it eats children, though." I said, "Not much meat on them. Perhaps the subject of another episode, then. Is the situation the same as when we last spoke? Two larvae loose, 10 set to arrive at any moment?" I said, "As far as we know, and Amy objects to killing them because they look like children." Amy stared down Marconi and said, "Could you shoot a child in the face because somebody else was insisting it was really a monster?" Marconi put on a pair of wireframe reading glasses and said, "You are living in a cruel world, Miss Sullivan. You see that oak tree by the parking lot? That tree is a murderer. It would commit genocide if it could. Those leaves serve two purposes, to collect sunlight to nourish the tree, and to block sunlight from anything below it. Its height is a result of competition, growing taller than the plants next to it, getting between them and the sun, starving them out. When you stroll through a tranquil forest, you are actually walking through a battlefield. It's just that the attacks and counterattacks occur too slowly and quietly for you to perceive their ruthlessness. Do you enjoy the smell of fresh-cut grass? What you are smelling is a chemical panic signal released by each blade in the moment its head was severed. That is the nature of the universe in which we live, thus. If another species has designs on mankind, the choice has been made for us." I said, "Exactly." Marconi said, "However, it is very easy to fall into the fallacy held by every violent zealot and corrupt policeman in the world, the idea that we are always faced with only two options, fierce violence and cowardly inaction. Real life provides us with a vast array of nuanced choices. As for me, I try to hold to one central rule in all circumstances. Do not act out of ignorance. I said, well, I'd never get out of bed.
With that in mind, said Marconi, we need a reliable method for seeing through the worker swarm's camouflage, one that does not require the observer to ingest any extraordinarily dangerous substances.
I have a method I'd like to test, but I need a specimen. I said, is that like that questionnaire they used on the humanoid robots in Blade Runner?
Amy said, the Voight Kampf.
I've got that whole Rutger Hauer speech memorized, if that will help.
As far as a specimen, I guess you could try to bring in the Knoll girl, if the parents will cooperate.
Marconi shrugged, making a show of being casual.
Of course. But if you do not mind, I would like to test it now, just to get a general feel for the process. With those of us in the room, get some control results down before diving in with an actual specimen. There will be no battery of confusing questions, just some cameras and an audience of some friends working off-site.
None of us moved. We all just looked at Marconi in silence.
He said, it won't take but a few minutes.
I turned to John and said, Marconi thinks we're doppelgangers. Amy, looking the most nervous of the three of us, said, this is part of the test, by the way, seeing if we're willing to do it. Marconi said, that should actually put you at ease. If you were not human, there would be a substantial risk of you becoming violent at the mere suggestion of a test. And as you can see, I have taken no unusual precautions for such an eventuality. Yet, already there has been too much hesitation.
John said, all right, but if we do this, we do it right. I don't want some bullshit like Kurt Russell pulled in The Thing, where we're all tied up in the same room with somebody when they monster out. We go in one at a time, lock the door, everybody else waits outside the room, ready to escape.
I said, that is the exact sort of thing a hive of shape-shifting monsters would suggest.
We'll see about that.
John turned his eyes on Marconi and said,
I assume we'll need to be nude for this?
We did not.
John volunteered to go first. Marconi started setting up an array of various types of cameras on his desk, all pointing at his chair.
In situations like this, he said, I have had some success with layers of remote perception. You mentioned earlier that the Mikey Payton doppelganger was able to maintain his camouflage even through a live video feed from outside the motel room. But every living entity has limitations. Here, I have four different devices: digital video, heat signature, ultraviolet, and a sensor pulled from a video game peripheral, which creates a 3D map of the physical objects in the room using a method similar to sonar. The feeds from each are monitored by dozens of members of an internet message board located in various parts of the world, who will each be able to observe the feeds and type up, via text, exactly what they are seeing. Members cannot see what the others are posting, and thus cannot be influenced as a group. My hypothesis is that we have here a sort of camouflage that works on the observer end, but as they say, you cannot fool all of the people all of the time. So the concept is to simply give the organism too many observers in too many places, viewing it through too many different wavelengths for it to maintain its subterfuge. To mimic plausible feedback from hundreds of strangers being read simultaneously by three of us would simply be too much. That is the hope, anyway.
John sat at the desk, and Marconi moved to the cramped lounge area outside his office where he had set up a laptop that would monitor the feedback in real time. He motioned for me to close the door to the office. I made eye contact with John and said, I just want you to know, if it turns out you're a fake person inserted into my memory, my whole life will make so much more sense.
I was just thinking the same thing.
I locked him in. The door seemed fairly sturdy,
and the remaining three of us huddled on an uncomfortable little fold-out sofa so we could all see Marconi's laptop. The man smelled like cologne and fancy pipe tobacco. The feeds were switched on and dried vomit cascading down the side of the sofa. I found myself holding my breath. The laptop screen was split into quadrants, one for each camera feed. We didn't see what the cameras were capturing. We only saw the scrolling text from the collective feedback from each. That was the idea. Digital video. I see a dude sitting in a chair, got long hair, handsome, but in a way that makes me want to punch him. Ultraviolet. Man sitting in a chair, looks like he's on heroin. Sonar. Either a male or a tall, flat-chested girl, nothing weird unless there's not supposed to be anybody sitting there. Heat signature. Shape is like a tall, thin male. Check around the pelvis area. Oh God, he has an erection! And so on. Nearly 300 messages were posted, split across the four feeds, with little variation aside from people trying too hard to pick out curiosities in the background. That doctorate doesn't appear to be from an accredited university. Marconi, Amy, and I took turns reading the messages out loud, all of us agreeing we were seeing the same text. We declared that round of testing over. I stuck my head through the doorway and said, "All clear, but the machine does show you have herpes. Also, Marconi wants to do a drug test after this is done." Amy was next. And strangely, I wasn't as nervous for her. It honestly wouldn't matter what they said. They'd be wrong. They might as well tell me the universe doesn't exist. Amy is my constant. She is the only reason I continue to do any of this. If she's not real, then my life isn't real, and I'm not real, and nothing matters anyway. If she's a monster, then I'll take her home and hug her, and we'll be monsters together. We locked her in, and John took her place on the narrow sofa. He watched the scrolling messages and said, "Marconi, your fans are kind of dicks." Still, that was as alarming as the revelations got. Digital video. Red-headed girl with glasses, pretty eyes, but body is nothing special. Is she missing a hand? Ultraviolet. Looks like a girl with bad posture. Does she only have one hand? Heat signature. Heat pattern looks like a petite girl, nothing weird. One hand doesn't show up for some reason. Did she have it dipped in ice water or something? Sonar. See a girl, sitting with her legs crossed. Might be cute, but I'd need to see the full-color vid. And there were a few of the obligatory, "Wait, is that who I think it is?" I let out a breath. It was my turn in the chair. Four different electronic eyes stared me down. Marconi asked me if I wanted anything, and I said no, which really is one of the biggest lies I've ever told. He made an adjustment to one of the cameras. Viewers asked for a wider view of the background, he said, and then he and John left the room. Amy, however, closed the door with her still on my side of it. She took a seat in front of the desk and looked right at me. I said, "A bunch of Marconi fans want your phone number. I look like I slept in a warehouse. Good thing they couldn't smell me." Honestly, while this is a very clever setup and I can see what Marconi was going for, I don't see why it would, "Oh, fuck!" From the next room, John, not Marconi. Amy jumped to her feet, but didn't make an effort to leave. I said, "What?" From the other side of the door, Marconi said, "One moment, please." I said, "I am not a monster larva." John, sounding like he was pressed up against the door, said, "It doesn't show that. He changed the setup and it's, what does it show?" Marconi said, "Please remain calm. What does it show?" John said, "You have one in the room with you." I was jumping to my feet now, knocking the chair over. "What? Where? Can you see it?" I stared at Amy. "It can't be. They're saying it's that snowman thing." I said, "The what?" I turned and looked at the filthy, misshapen concrete monstrosity, Mr. Icy etched on its chest, and have I seen it before? Shards of broken memories went spraying across my mind. A dozen contradictory origin stories of this stupid concrete snowman wearing a shawl of bird shit. None of the memories making a bit of sense. The thing's misshapen, eroded mouth started moving, and out from it came the sound of screams, small voices in abject panic, a roomful of children pleading for their mothers, begging for mercy, moaning in pain. Its mouth grew, and the noises grew louder, filling the room, vibrating my skull. Then, the snowman exploded into a swirl of panicked and enraged fuckroaches. Amy screamed. The door lock clicked, and the door opened, John coming in, completely defeating the purpose of the whole setup. I batted at the creatures with my hands and tried frantically to locate the larva itself. They kept getting in front of me, creating images, people. The swarm formed a face, my face, the nymph version. I swatted at them, grabbing one of the fuckroaches. It held the shape of my own laughing mouth and crushed it in my hand. They couldn't fool me, not now. They scattered, then coalesced again, this time as my mother, a face I barely remembered. I smashed it with my fist. The whizzing insects were screeching and crying and laughing in voices from my past, the things sloppily sifting through my mind for something, anything. I heard Jim and Arnie and TJ and Hope and Jennifer and Chrissy and Todd and Robert. I heard Molly's bark. I heard them imitate Amy, making her cry and beg, saying things that made it sound like I was her attacker. I heard John, and I think it was the real John, say, "It's behind you!" At the exact moment the larva crashed into my back, knocking me to the floor, sending the fuckroaches scattering once more. I rolled over just as the maggot raised up a mouth ringed by mandibles, at the center a gulping throat that made a sound like a drunken kiss in the back of a taxi. I tried to fight it off, but it thrust its mouth down onto the side of my face, covering one ear. The mandibles bit down and there was an explosion of pain. Then all pain disappeared. It was replaced by a vague warmth. And I don't mean the disgusting warmth like when you squeeze a bag of dog shit in your hand. It was warm like a hug, like a shared bed in winter. And then it was the weirdest thing. The center of the universe just shifted. In that moment, I was no longer the main character in my story. This thing that was attached to me, it was what mattered. It didn't hate me. It didn't hate anyone. It was hungry and cold and scared. In me, it found nourishment and warmth and safety. It not only didn't wish me harm, it desperately needed me to remain safe and whole, to be the provider. It wanted nothing more than for us to survive, together, in a universe that would just as readily see us die alone and forgotten. In that moment, the creature was no longer afraid because I was there. I was the rock it could cling to. I think that was the first time in my life I was really proud of myself. And then, the creature recoiled as if struck or electrocuted. It unhooked itself, writhed, and rolled off onto the floor next to me. I thought that John or Marconi had attacked it, but it had recoiled on its own. It had found that I was not its father, that I was poison, that I had nothing to offer. It cried out in despair. No, wait, that was me. I reached out for it, but I was being dragged from the room. The fuckroaches were getting their act together now, landing on the larva, covering it, recombobulating themselves into some new form. Then I was pulled through the door and John slammed it shut, locking it. Amy was kneeling over me, asking if I was okay, examining my face. From behind the door came the familiar screech of the maggot. Marconi got a look on his face that made me ask, "Who are you hearing?" "A boy," Amy said. "It's being Mikey again, begging us to let him out." There was a moment when I could see doubt creep into Marconi's eyes, the fuckroach's voodoo starting to take hold. We quickly ushered him out of the RV, slammed the door, and got some distance away from the vehicle. We stood there, in the Walmart parking lot in silence, listening to the rain making army marching sounds on our skulls. We tried to catch our breath. John said, "Well, it's Mikey's bus now. Does that mean he gets to host your show?" Marconi said, "We gained some crucial information. Specifically, the fact that your soy sauce does not give you perfect detection. And, more importantly, that the workers have the ability to imitate an inanimate object.
John said, "We actually already knew that. The first trick we saw one pull after we captured it was to mimic my cell phone. Sorry, I think I forgot to mention that."
That would have been useful, yes, to know that not only any person or animal we encounter could in fact be these creatures in disguise, but literally anything in the environment itself, any object in the universe.
The implications of that are almost beyond my comprehension.
Amy said, "Hey, remember when this was just a missing persons case? I felt bumps on my face where the maggot had bitten me. Itchy, but not painful. That brief feeling of attachment. I felt dirty just thinking about it. I wasn't sure why."
I said, "Just out of curiosity, Marconi, where did you think you had gotten a concrete snowman from?"
"It was a supposed haunted artifact from a quaint post-war ice cream parlor in Vermont. I remember the case well. The owner of the establishment was a feisty old Scottish woman named..."
He trailed off.
"Her face fades, even as I try to bring it to mind."
"Fascinating."
I said, "That's one word for it."
"Well, shit, now what?"
John glanced behind him and said, "Nan's here." The agents rolled into the parking lot of the abandoned Walmart in a black sedan. The female agent I knew as Tasker stepped out, looked over Marconi's TV production RVs, and said, "So when I told you to go home and avoid leaking anything about the case?" She was accompanied by her recently deceased male partner, Gibson, who was walking with a cane and seemed to be having some difficulty.
John said, "I see you're up and around."
He grunted,
"Fuck off."
There was a thump, and Amy jumped. Mikey's face appeared in a window near the rear of the RV. He was crying and clawing at the glass.
"Help! That old man lured me into his RV and he made me watch a puppet show he put on with his pee-pee."
I said, "Hey, we captured a larva specimen. Need anything else?"
Tasker said, "We already have a vehicle on the way to retrieve it."
"You do? How did you..."
"You need to come with us. We're going to have a meeting."
Marconi said, "Am I invited?"
"No, this is not going to be part of your reality show, Doctor."
She turned back to me.
"We're going to come up with a plan of action, and you're going to be on board with it, and you're going to stop impeding our every move. We have the exact same goal. There is no reason we can't work together."
John said, "Other than the fact that you would literally murder us right now if you could."
"Society is nothing more than people cooperating with other people they'd much rather murder. Listen to what we have to say. You'll find out. We're not the bad guys here."
Chapter 22. The heroes agree to help murder a dozen children. I was hoping we'd get to ride inside one of the non-vehicles. I was curious to see the interior, but apparently that wasn't allowed for non-employees, so we were simply told to follow them to the meeting location. I wasn't surprised to see that we were being led toward the converted farm supply store that was now calling itself the IAEEAI Lab and Wellness Center. I wasn't quite sure what kind of occult temple shit to expect inside the building that Nan was apparently using as a field HQ, but it was kind of disappointing. Inside was an open space that had been recently renovated for use as offices and could easily have passed for an insurance company's customer support call center. Past an unmanned reception desk were cubicles and glassed-in conference rooms. Against the wall to our right was a series of vending machines and that black coffin thing they'd rolled out in the parking lot a couple of days ago. The portable doorway to wherever. A man in an orange jumpsuit walked over to it and opened the door. On the other side, I got a glimpse of what appeared to be a green field on a sunny day. The guy took the last gulp from a styrofoam coffee cup, tossed the cup through the door, then closed it. The office area was only half of the building, however, and the insurance company illusion ended abruptly at a concrete wall with a thick, sliding steel door in the center.
so probably not a supply closet. There was a row of red warning lights along the wall, and below them, large painted letters said, "If lights are flashing, perform rites of black veil. Failure equals nerve burn cycle. This means you." I thought we'd be taken to the coffin door to hold our meeting in some nightmare dimension where the office furniture was alive and the bagels screamed when you bit them. But no, we were just led to the largest conference room. Inside, one wall featured a single window granting us a view of the misty industrial park. Next to the window was an inspirational poster depicting a bunch of bees crawling over a honeycomb above the words, "Teamwork kills the wasp." At the center of the long conference table was a phone with speakers snaking out like the arms of a very spindly and fragile robot octopus. Tasker directed us to sit on the opposite side of the table from her. Agent Gibson shuffled over and sat next to his partner with some difficulty, leaning his cane against the table next to him. Tasker said, "Do you want a drink or any refreshments before we begin?" John and I said no. Amy said, "Does your chip vending machine have those spicy Cheetos in it? I have change." I shot her an annoyed look, but as usual, it just bounced off her. To my horror, Agent Tasker nodded to Gibson, who sighed and with a monumental effort climbed to his feet and shuffled out of the conference room, across the vast concrete floor, and over to the vending machine. He returned and tossed the Cheetos bag onto the table in front of Amy and began the laborious multi-step process of sitting back down. Amy noisily tore open the bag with her teeth and shook some Cheetos into her mouth. Tasker said, "Now, you are to remain silent unless asked a direct question. You are not being invited onto this call to offer your opinion, and this is not subject to a vote. You may or may not be asked for information. It will be explained to you what the next course of action will be, and we will seek reassurance that you will not interfere. Are we clear?" Amy said, "I'm sorry, the crunching is really loud in my head. I think I got the gist of it, though." Tasker punched a button on the phone, then dialed, then entered a 12-digit code. There was a tone, and she leaned forward. "Sorry, we're late. I'm going to do a roll call. Utah, are you on?" The answer was muffled clicking noises. "Utah, I'm not hearing you."
"We're here. Is this better?"
"Yes, thank you. Las Vegas?"
"We're here."
"Chicago?" "We're on, Jocelyn." "Bangkok?" An answer in a language I assumed was Thai. "Effingham?" Another answer in a language I didn't recognize. "Bernard, I understand you're calling in from the road." The reply was the sound of an electronic voice announcing that gate 34B was boarding. A breathless male voice then came on and said, "Sorry, I'm here. I'm at the airport. Let me get to a quiet spot." "And do we have HQ on the line?" The answer was a series of deep rumbles, like the sound a mountain would make if it had gotten woken up in the middle of the night by the neighbor's loud music. I assumed it was the phone glitching again, but Tasker nodded as if she could hear it clearly and said, "Yes, all three of them are here, my lord." I exchanged a look with John. Amy stopped chewing. Agent Gibson sat up straighter, as if not completely sure the thing on the line couldn't see him. Tasker, in her most professional voice, said, "You've all been briefed, and I assume you reviewed the memo I sent out approximately 12 minutes ago. The issue, as you know, is that Undisclosed is in the middle of a Class G outbreak with at least one larva attached to a living host and a second now in containment en route to this facility. Though there are no sightings as of yet, we now have reason to believe that 10 more will manifest themselves, their origins already implanted in a group of human hosts. We've brought in the three locals discussed on yesterday's call to talk about options for containment. They are in the room with me now. You should see their dossiers on your screens, designated 919A, 919B, and John." A male voice said,
"Hey, this is Tom in Houston. Is this the budget call?"
"No, it is not. That was moved to Thursday at 2. Now, as you know, the outbreak can be traced to the entity we have designated B3333B. which is attempting its second breach via a reproduction cycle that has not previously been observed. Amy said, "Excuse me, can you tell me what a Class G outbreak is?"
An annoyed voice on the phone said, "Who is that speaking?"
"Amy Sullivan? I'm one of the locals. Is a Class G, is that on a scale from A to Z? If so, is A the worst or is Z?"
Tasker said, "Class G is potential extinction level. Please remain silent until asked a question. Now, the method for terminating the larva discussed in the memo was tested during Incident 404 12 years ago, and the results were very, very promising. We will proceed in two stages. First, we must track and collect the larva and contain them in one location if possible, preferably here in the field office. Second, we must create a satisfactory cover story for the termination of same. There will then be a separate operation to disrupt the breeding cycle of B3333B itself." Amy said, "Hi, it's me again, but just to clarify, we're discussing a plan for kidnapping and murdering a total of 12 children in a country where the entire news cycle catches fire over one missing kid? And the idea is to do that in such a way that nobody will care or even be slightly curious."
"Got it."
A deep rumble emerged from the speaker, the voice from HQ. Everyone went quiet. Tasker said, "It won't happen again, my lord. Now, the concerns raised by 919B are valid. The cover story will be paramount. The world will believe these children have perished." Amy said, "Plus any parents or other concerned types who try to get in the way. We will try to minimize that." An elderly female voice spoke up on the phone for the first time.
"This is Martha, and I want to register my objection right now. I was told, assured, that first on the agenda for today would be the allocation of funds for the Miami Project. We've been waiting on this since January, guys. This can't wait any longer."
Tasker said, "This isn't the budget call, Martha." Amy said, "It's Thursday, at 2. Tasker grimaced, rubbed her temples, and said, "The cover story will involve an incident that would leave no recognizable bodies behind, for obvious reasons." John said, "Right, like if they fell into the ocean and got eaten by sharks." Amy said, "Why would they be in the ocean?" John said, "We could have them win a contest or something. Oh, make it a plane crash. Tell them they won a trip. Plane goes down in the ocean, in the part of the ocean where there are the most sharks. So these kids get to experience the terror of a plane plummeting to Earth?" I said, "They're not kids, and we have no indication that they can experience terror. And you don't need anything like that. You just need to do it in such a way that the public sees it as unavoidable." Amy said, "How in the world do you do that?" I said, "You say the kids are infected with some weaponized disease, Ebola, whatever. Say Nymph did it, and you've got to quarantine the kids to keep anybody else from getting sick. Say you're bringing them in for treatment. Then once you've got them in quarantine, just say they succumbed to the infection, that it was too late. Then tell them Nymph is dead and that there are no other victims. Tie up the whole story with a neat little bow." There was silence in the room. The rumble from HQ sounded. Tasker looked very nervous. Amy looked back and forth from me to Tasker and said to the latter, "That's your exact plan, isn't it?" "I don't know how to feel about that." "Not Ebola," said Tasker. "That would be a recipe for panic. Polonium-210 poisoning. Slow-acting, fatal, but not contagious. Still, the corpse is mildly radioactive, and we would explain that we will be unable to release the bodies of the children for safety reasons." John nodded. "Then you put the radioactive bodies on a plane and arrange for the plane to crash right into the mine monster. The radioactive material in the kids' bodies triggers a nuclear explosion." Tasker tried to pretend she hadn't heard that. Forcing calm into her voice, she said, "Again? All we need from you is your assurances that you are not going to interfere." Amy said, "Wait, you're asking our permission?"
We don't need your permission. There is no reason we can't all be in agreement.
And if we're not in agreement, you'll have to find some other way.
We would discuss that.
But you can't harm us, so you need our permission.
I said, I don't think there's any disagreement here. You saw the larva attack me. That part of the debate is over.
To Tasker, I said, then we should be good to go, assuming